Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we're on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And today's guest is part of that revolution, part of igniting that revolution. His name is Aaron Anderson. He is a principal at Impact Ventures. He's also a teacher and a leader over at UC Davis. He's involved in their startup community. And today we're going to be talking about sort of lessons that he's picked up along the way. We hear a little bit about his journey, but we also get to talk about Sacramento's entrepreneurial ecosystem and how it's emerging, how it's beginning to blossom, if you will. So stick around. I think you're going to enjoy Aaron's story. And at the end of the show, stick around a little bit longer for the end of the show where I'm going to share a little bit about a book that helps us think about how we might want to build an entrepreneurial ecosystem. It's something I read a year or so ago, and I just thought of it when Aaron comes on the show, because he's talking about a few books, and one of them that we didn't mention was a book called The Rainforest. So I'll share a little bit about that at the end of the show. Stick around, my friends. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Aaron Anderson. He is a principal at Impact Venture Capital, as well as an accelerator at UC Davis. And before the show, he was asking me, Aaron said, hey, Mark, how many of these shows have you done? And my partner Scott and I were sort of calculating, and we think it's 350 plus episodes and maybe another couple hundred guests, because we used to do two and three people per show. So Aaron promised me that he would stand out today, because this is going to be the number one podcast that we have ever done. So welcome to the show, Aaron Anderson.
Mark, it's a pleasure. I've never gone viral before, so hopefully I can pull that off.
Let's do this. And you know, you are a venture capitalist, and one of the things that I saw in your bio, which had me intrigued, was that you are an aficionado of root beer. Okay, and you said that's what makes you, that's kind of what gets you to stand out sometimes. Okay, how did that happen?
Yeah, so look, I went to business school, did the whole undergrad thing, made the huge mistake of graduating in 2008. If you remember, the economy stopped working about that time. There weren't jobs to be had. Handed out a lot of resumes, didn't get a lot of return calls, needed a way to stand out. I loved root beer, not a lot of people did. Threw it in the bullet, and I kid you not, Mark, that's about the only thing that people ever asked me about.
That is amazing. I mean, you help startups. You're an educator at UC Davis, and I'm sure one of the things you talk about if you're building a business is you got to stand out. But I guess it stands for anybody who's trying to make an impact, get a job, do something important in their life. You got to figure out a way to stand out.
Yeah, you got to be different. I had a great professor in business school. Her name was Youngmi Moon, wrote a book called Different. That was basic premise was you needed to tell a story that stood out. Shoot, it didn't even always have to be a good story, just one that could be remembered, and then, you know, let the merit work from there.
Okay, so you went to BYU. I know you have a Harvard MBA, which makes this a kind of an awkward conversation. I'm a C student from Oakmont High School, but try to dumb it down for me a little bit today, because Aaron, my friends, is one of the smartest guys you'll ever meet, and he's an expert in venture capital. But tell us about your journey to getting into this arena.
Yeah, Mark, it's accidental. Like I wish I could told you it was a deliberate path all along. But the first thing you need to know about me is that I'm a military brat. So my dad was a pilot in the Air Force, flew mid-air refueling jets. Have you ever seen the two planes flying side by side?
Oh yeah.
Giving jet fuel one to the other. I always thought that was nuts, but I also thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah.
The reason I mention that is because my dad pursued this career, spent 25 years in the Air Force because he wanted to have a career that he felt made a difference in the world. Like, he wanted to have an impact. So I know you're a big supporter of the veterans in the military, mm-hmm. But you know, wherever people stand on the issue, the critical point here was my dad wanted to make a difference, and yeah. I inherited that bug. Like, I wanted a career that made an impact. Well, I didn't have the vision to be a pilot. I was disqualified from the get-go. So economic development became my thing. My ambition was to be the guy that solved poverty. So I went off to BYU. I studied economics and political science, and that's what I thought I was going to do. Very bold, very ambitious, very naive.
Solve poverty. Hey, at least it is ambitious. I mean, isn't when you say naive, it sounds possible to solve poverty.
So
entrepreneurs are going to figure this out, my friend.
this is the lesson I learned. So early on in my life, I did everything I could to avoid business for some reason. I don't know what I was smoking, but my first thought was the government route. So I got this killer internship at the State Department. I thought I was going to be a diplomat. That's how I was going to solve poverty. And so in 2007, I got a job with the U.S. State Department in Washington, D.C. on it was called the Near Eastern Affairs Desk. My job was literally to help support business interests in Iraq during the surge of the Second Gulf War. Needless to say, I was not very successful. War zones are not the easiest places to start businesses. But more to the point is that I just had a rough experience. Now, I want to be clear, it wasn't the State Department's fault. This was a cool job, great mission. But I found the bureaucracy of it all kind of crushing. I found it really hard. And so I left this internship thinking it was going to be my career, totally realizing it wasn't. So I'm like 20, I don't know, 3 years old, maybe having my very first midlife crisis. This is what I always thought I was going to do. What now? Well, kind of, tried the next route. And again, fighting the business role all the way, I went into the nonprofit world. So when I finished my degree, got married, and then 3 months later, my wife and I moved to South Africa. I got a job with Habitat for Humanity. And honestly, same experience. Great organization, killer mission, but I hated my job. Like, I didn't feel like I was having the impact that I wanted. And I got in a really bad way. I got in the habit of coming home every day and just complaining about things. Oh. I was one of those guys. Just complain, 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 rather than change anything. My poor wife, she knew what to do with me, though. We lived about two blocks from the local McDonald's. And that McDonald's was right adjacent to the University of Pretoria. It's one of these preeminent universities in South Africa. They had thousands of students from all over the continent. But we'd go to that McDonald's because you get an ice cream cone for like 40 cents. I love myself some McDonald's soft serve ice cream. Tasted like home when I was getting homesick, and we'd go there. But Mark, I remember distinctly one day sitting at our table doing my usual vent and complain. And I look into the kitchen and there's like a dozen university students from all over Africa working at this McDonald's. And it hit me in that moment that McDonald's was doing more to promote economic development in Africa than I was. And,
oh, wow.
And I hated that feeling. Like, you don't want McDonald's to be the good guy, you be the bad guy. I hated it. But I realized, like, if I'm ever going to do this poverty thing right, if I'm going to have an impact, I have to learn how business works. And I got really lucky. I got into Harvard. So this is kind of how I got myself to HBS. Truth be told, we talked about being different. My path was not like most students there. A lot of bankers, a lot of Wall Street folks, management consultants, big wigs, executives at large corporations. And I had this like nonprofit government background, but it was a story that stood out. So I'm not kidding myself when, I'm not more qualified than thousands of students that were turned away from the school, but I had a different experience and something else to contribute. And certainly a whole lot to learn. I think I'm the only one there who got his money's worth in tuition in terms of education. But yeah, that's how I got myself to school.
Yeah. And then you got yourself to venture capital did you come straight to Sacramento from Harvard?
Yeah, so that's right. So I'm from Davis. So I military guy. Yeah. This is where I went to high school. Davis was as home as anywhere was. So I'm doing my MBA, it's a two-year program. I'm wrestling with this idea of, is it time for a major career pivot or am I serious about this economic development effort? While trying to figure that out, I get this call from Mayor Kevin Johnson, the mayor of Sacramento at the time, and they're looking for some help on the economic development side, the workforce efforts, recruiting businesses. So, come to Sacramento, come home and do this. It was great for me. I love the idea of coming home. We were expecting baby number one at the time. It just made too much sense. And so we made the leap back to California. In my role at the mayor's office, speaking of pivoting, I found it was not easy to recruit large businesses to Sacramento. Companies coming to the state were too often going to the Bay Area or LA. Mm-hmm. Companies leaving those cities were often leaving the state entirely for tax reasons. And we were in this strange middle ground. But what I learned and what I realized working with really smart people was, well, there's a lot of compelling reasons to launch a business in Sacramento. So, rather than spend all my time recruiting, that's when I got introduced to entrepreneurship as a profession. Like, we're going to use entrepreneurship as a tool to promote economic development, to help lift people up. Yeah. And, venture capital was a natural evolution from there. I've been doing it ever since. And it's my passion, Mark.
Well, I'm going to let that lead. We're going to talk for listeners out there educate me. I think there's some education in an Aaron's story about standing out and not settling for a job you don't like, and maybe coming home back to your roots is can be a good decision in many cases. You don't have to leave Sacramento to change the world, but now there's sort of this uphill battle. You've become a venture capitalist, and you've been doing it for how long?
Since 2015, six, pushing 7 years.
Yeah, and so you're teaching you're teaching entrepreneurship. It's UC Davis. I can't speak. And you're a venture capitalist, so you have these two roles, and you've been doing it a while, so you've become very well. You become very knowledgeable in this area. But in terms of driving economic growth for the city, that's a long-term type of proposition. So maybe before we get into the education about how to be a venture capitalist or what venture capital is all about, how would you describe the transformation since you made the pivot to venture capital?
I think it was Sheryl Sandberg said something to the effect of if you're offered a ride on a rocket ship, you just take the ticket. You don't ask which seat, you just get on the rocket ship and take off. I feel that way about Sacramento as a region. So we got a lot of really good things going for us, and I feel like the city is about to take off. Some obvious ones. We're proximate to the Bay Area, which means the tech, talent, and capital of the Bay is readily accessible to entrepreneurs in Sacramento, which is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Finding those first investment dollars is often the hardest part of entrepreneurship, apart from finding those first few customers, which is the most important thing you can do. So that's great. And we've seen a lot of folks kind of migrate this way. Even before COVID was happening, for no other reason than cost of living in the Bay is high, Sacramento was a nice release valve, I think, for those kind of pressures. But in a post-COVID world where you can work from home, Sacramento is perfectly positioned because, great place to live. Just, whether you like the mountains, the river, or whatever you like, it's just a great place to live. But on those few instances where hopping on a Zoom call doesn't make sense, you can still get yourself down to San Francisco real easy. So I see Sacramento as this great bridge. But if that is all we had going for us, I wouldn't be as optimistic as I am. The way I see the world right now is that there are some major technology opportunities that are going to be solving major world problems, world challenges, whether that's the need we have to feed the population as it grows by another billion people, providing clean energy for those folks, healthcare and healing for, again, a billion more people. Sacramento is good at all of these things. The UC Davis Med Center in Sacramento is a world-class research institute, just got some huge new investment with Amazon that they're going to take off. Aggie Square is taking off. Mm-hmm. If ag tech is your thing in agriculture, where else would you want to be but here in the Central Valley?
I hear you.
And what's really interesting about all of this is these are also highly regulated industries. And so if you as an entrepreneur know how to navigate the regulatory and the policy world, then you have a huge competitive advantage. And Sacramento is the capital of the state of California, one of the largest economies on the planet and a big city. Well, shoot. You got a lot of great ingredients here to do amazing things. Yeah. But there's $1 billion spent on research in the region alone every year.
It definitely feels like we're emerging. There's been a number of seeds planted. There's been some success start to happen in the startup world. And I've always felt like success breeds success because it becomes a confidence boost. When one founder is successful, then other people kind of catch wind of that.
Right.
And it's like, if he can do it or she can do it, hey, maybe I can do it too. And so the optimism begins to spread. And now it can really catch fire.
Right. One domino can knock over 10,000. A little snowball becomes an avalanche. Mm-hmm. I think the metaphor is appropriate for what's going on here in Sacramento.
So you think about trends. Obviously, Sacramento is the asset class venture capital is blowing up. We know it's blowing up worldwide. It's blowing up across America. It's continuing to grow. You think about I watch CNBC a lot. What do you think could disrupt this growing trend in venture capital?
Boy, so there are a lot of things that I think will transform within the world of venture capital. But I am and will always be bullish on entrepreneurship in general. So venture capital is interesting in that it focuses pretty much exclusively on high growth, innovation driven enterprise, a specific type of entrepreneurship. And I think that's important. I remember a stat one time from the mayor's office, something like every high tech job you create supports 5 more jobs in the broader economy. Whether that's the extra restaurant you need to go to at lunchtime or the assistant that helps you with the work, whatever it might be. But that's also not the only kind of entrepreneurship. We need small business, enterprise. Like, life is not worth living if I can't go.
That's the backbone of our country. Exactly. They do create a lot of jobs.
Right. And so what I hope to see, where I see challenges, is that venture capital lends itself really neatly and nicely for software. You know, if you can code it quickly, you know, the catchphrase is always, we want bits, not atoms, meaning we want software, not something physical. And that makes sense. Like, you can get a lot of great companies. They scale quickly. They grow rapidly. That's exactly the kind of investment venture investors want to make, because it's high risk. You know, if we make 20 investments, 10 of them will probably go belly up. Another 5 might break even. And so you need 1 or 2 superstars to make the whole fund return pencil out. And so... Where I have a fear, where I hope we can figure this out, is, well, we need high-tech innovation in the world where there are atoms, where there are physical products. Agriculture and healthcare are not pure software plays. Likewise, we need to be able to find ways to invest in our small business entrepreneurs. Like, they need that support and help. And so a lot of that is just an economy working well, that's, you know, equitably shared, that people can access it, that it's relevant to them. We have a lot of talent and a lot of big brains in Sacramento. Not many of them are thinking about entrepreneurship, and many of them don't have access to it. And so when I think about my work at UC Davis, the other work going well at, you know, Sac State, and the other educational institutions on campus, or excuse me, in the city, it's all about, you know, how do I help a first-generation college student to become an entrepreneur, or, you know, an immigrant family, someone who, you know, how can I think about being a founder if I'm helping my parents pay the bills or got to cover my tuition cost? And so that's where I think we need to do better.
How much of that is education and people just becoming exposed to what's possible? I've sat in groups where people they'd never even heard of the term venture capital or limited partner or, you know, entrepreneur, maybe even not even entrepreneur.
Right. Oh, I think that's a huge part of it. So, I mean, look, I'd be kidding myself if I said I didn't have a great educational experience. I went to 2 great schools. I was really, really lucky. And I knew nothing about entrepreneurship until, like, I'm graduating from business school. So if I'm a guy that had every opportunity in the world and I was ignorant, yeah, there's a lot of folks that are missing it. But I think it's more than just education of, like, the nuts and bolts, the blocking and tackling of startups and entrepreneurship. I think there's also, you know, how do I meet the right people? How do they open doors for me? Because if all I'm thinking about in college or even before college is I just need to pay the bills, like, that lends itself to a really low risk appetite. But if we can help these folks not only understand, like, how you can open these doors, but here are the people you need to know that can help you along the way. My good buddy Cameron Law once said to me, you know, your network is your net worth. And I mean, that resonated with me like nothing else ever has. If we can help these individuals build networks of support and help, well, then we're untapping the potential of, you know, the 2.5 million people that live in the city, not just the 500 that might be entrepreneurially minded now.
And Cameron Law, he runs the Carlson Center at Sac State, really doing great things for our community in terms of entrepreneurship and innovation. You said it's kind of interesting to think about the way Sacramento can come together and is coming together in this entrepreneurial ecosystem. Dale Carlson and I are working together on the Growth Factory along with you and Cameron, but there's a teamwork that's emerging that I don't remember seeing when I first started this podcast 350 shows ago.
Yeah, no, it's there's something in the water. It's changing here. The term I like to hear is co-opetition, I think.
You
slam cooperation and competition together. Because what you don't want is just a bunch of folks patting each other's backs and, you know, smiling and saying good job. Like, we need to be real. What marks the best startup economies from everything else is the access they have to global markets. And so where Sacramento maybe fell short in our history was that we were very regional, you know, parochial almost in our vision. You know, it was kind of a real estate and government town, and you know, that served some folks well, but it, you know, we didn't kind of reach beyond, say, like our 6-county region. But the startups I see today in Sacramento, you know, they're out to conquer the world. Yes. And that's when it changes. When you provide a service that's as relevant in Sacramento as it is in Bangalore or Hong Kong or, you know, wherever in the world, that's great. And that's why I think these industries that we're good at are so important. You know, agriculture, relevant everywhere. Same with healthcare. I mean, even government technology. If we can find ways to to build tech companies that help governments run more efficiently and effectively. I mean, goodness gracious. That made me happy.
Yeah. Well, so the Growth Factory has an emphasis on, not just an emphasis, we invest only into Sacramento regional companies and companies that can make an impact here as they have success. At Impact, you have a different kind of specific focus. How do you decide what's a good company?
Yeah, so I wish I could say Impact was focused exclusively on Sacramento as the local
cheerleader.
You guys invest
here too?
We definitely do. So our thesis at Impact is, I mean, we're early stage investors. We like to be the first institutional money into the startups we invest in. Predominantly focused on artificial intelligence, so software companies that are using AI in some way to impact the industry they're going after. One way we really try to do things differently is the degree to which we work with corporate venture capital. So for those who are unaware, corporate venture capital has become a major trend in the world of VC in the last 4 or 5 years or so.
And let's talk about what that is. So somebody raises money from someone like Impact. Maybe the Growth Factory comes in and offers some really early money and some training and some guidance. And then Impact follows on as they begin to get some traction. You throw in some money. And then there's all kinds of venture capitalists in the world. You're talking about corporate VCs that might make an investment either alongside you or maybe after you.
Right.
All right. So it's different. It's money coming from corporations. Am I right?
It's exactly right. So their interest is often, but not always, more strategic than a traditional venture capitalist is. So, you know, certainly they want to get a return on their investment like every investor does, but maybe we also want access or, you know, insight into major trends in a technology that might be relevant to our main line of business. And our two founding general partners, Eric Ball and Jack Crawford, both had deep experience in the world of corporate venture capital through Oracle, of all companies. And so it's something we try to do well. We like to identify companies, startups that are relevant to our corporate partners, invest before those corporate partners can invest, help scale them up, and kind of, you know, lay them out for the corporate venture group afterwards. Because the corporate venture capitalists, they're really good at, you know, helping find, you know, customers at scale, sometimes even manufacturing. So just to kind of illustrate an example, we made an investment into a Davis company called Advance Farm.
Oh, yeah. They were on the show a couple years back.
Love those guys. Really cool robot, picks strawberries autonomously, really slick. So we made an early investment into them, and we're able to introduce them into Yamaha's corporate venture group. And Yamaha built a syndicate of other CVCs, corporate venture companies, that led the next round. And so Advanced Farms, you know, and now they're running because they got these big checks coming from multinational corporations doing something relevant around the world.
So why does Yamaha want to get involved with a strawberry picking machine?
Yeah, so
I know that's not, it's more than that, but it's high tech stuff in ag. Is Yamaha, I think of them as like motorcycles.
Yeah, so I mean, you're right. But they also do, you know, tractors and all sorts of big machines. And so maybe to illustrate the point, so Yamaha co-invested with another firm called Kubota. You know, they're all about those kind of tractors and such. And so, you know, there's some direct obvious lines where it's, well, if we sell tractors, what is the future of tractors? But you know, autonomous machines in general could be relevant.
Mm-hmm. Do they want the technology, the talent, or a return on investment financially?
So all of the above and more. You know, what they don't want is to be totally disruptive, you know, caught with your pants down, unable to compete anymore. Mm-hmm. And there's a long history of well-established companies that got blindsided by a tech play. You know, Blockbuster is kind of the quintessential example. They weren't worried about Netflix until Netflix beat them. So no corporate wants that to happen.
So if you have a bureaucratic business or the culture is just not set up to drive innovation that competes with the likes of these startups, you might as well invest. If you can't build it, go ahead and just buy into it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so we're seeing more and more of that. It's a common play, these corporate
groups. How often does that turn into a more of an acqui-hire? Because we got the talent and we get the tech. We'll buy you an early valuation pretty much for the team.
Yeah. So in our case, we hope never. So the trick with an acqui-hire,
that's not a very good – it's not as good a return for an acqui-hire.
Yeah,
for a VC.
I think the rule of thumb is something like you pay $1 million, maybe $1 million and change for every engineer on the team for an acqui-hire. You know, so you're talking, you know, maybe a $10 million deal. You know, our goal is to, you know, order of magnitude or two more than that. You know, we want hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in the exits when they happen. So Truth be told, I don't think that's very common. So if a corporate were interested in acqui-hire, I mean, they would just hire the people. Like, why buy the whole thing?
Well, it's interesting when you're choosing your investments, kind of back to that. There's some people that would be happy with, they start a startup and they'd be happy with an acqui-hire, right? Right. Hey, $10 million, that sounds great. And if I'm the employee, I got a great contract at the end of the, you know, I'm working for Kubota and or Yamaha. You know, it's not a loss for an entrepreneur. It's not good for the VC.
Right. Well, so this is where it's critical that you know the founders really well before you make an investment. You need to make sure everyone's goals are aligned. Because that would be not a good outcome. I mean, not an awful outcome, but it's certainly not the business we're in. We need the big wins for the fund to work. And so, you know, if that's the ambition of the founder, more power to them. That's not a bad outcome for them. You're right. But we're not going to make that investment. We're not interested. Yeah. And I think most corporate venture groups actually feel the same, because their goal is to see, you know, where can this technology go? And the great thing about an investment is, you know, I don't want to be flippant about it, but you can almost wash your hands of, you know, make the investment. Let's see where you run. And if it goes really, really well, that's great. And if not, it wasn't as expensive as like actually hiring the whole team, creating a department within the company and fighting the politics that come with it. The great thing about corporate venture capital for the corporates is it gives independence and autonomy to the startup, where the corporate politics or bureaucracy might kill it when it would have survived otherwise.
You know, I talked about the trend of growth in venture capital. What other trends are you seeing besides the fact that the asset class is growing? What other trends are you seeing emerge?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm always looking out for technology trends, like what's going to change the world. You hear a lot of people talking today about Web 3.0, you know, the blockchain and what that's going to look like. Metaverse, the metaverse is a big buzzword.
Can't like, stop thinking. You know, CNBC is talking about that, and I mean, all day long.
So I always want to be careful with the hype cycle. You know, like people get really excited, a lot of money comes flooding in, and you know, things come crashing down.
A lot of times, it takes longer than expected for one of these emerging technologies to become mainstream or highly valuable to the public.
Well, so I'm not an expert. You get really timid talking on a microphone because someone's going to hold you accountable for it 2 years from now. But like, I think about Web 3.0, and it's defined, you know, by a number of things. But you know, this kind of decentralization of the internet, users and content creators kind of owning their content, being able to monetize it more easily. You know, talk a lot about the metaverse and like, you know, like this 3D interface with the internet, whether that's literally like 3D worlds and virtual reality or even just our ability to use voice commands, kind of the ubiquity of the internet. So you're not just hopping on your computer or your tablet or your smartphone, but literally every device connected to the internet and the Internet of Things. Like, you know, there's a lot of reasons to be excited about that potential. But you also see, you know, like, you know, these NFTs selling for millions of dollars where it's like a picture of a monkey. And I'm like, you know, maybe, but this feels...
For somebody listening that maybe hasn't heard of NFTs, I'm not saying you've been living under a rock, but they're non-fungible tokens, and you're basically buying something fake, right?
It's a
replica.
It's
like a baseball card.
It's exactly. So, you know, a digital asset that you can claim ownership to. Now, that... There's a lot of this that feels a lot like the Beanie Baby craze of, you know, my teenage years. But there's also great opportunities. So, you know, if there's a digital token tied to, you know, the title of my car or just even like the, you know, the serial number on my bicycle, or, you know, if I could keep a digital record of all my assets that made it easier to buy and sell them. Like, that's a lot of value there. So I am not dismissive about the opportunities, not even close. But I do, you know, like every new wave, there's going to be a lot of hype.
Yeah, it's very speculative. And if you think about trends, it's like, it feels to me, and I don't know if you would agree with this, or maybe you have data supporting, that people in general are becoming more speculative. They want to bet on crypto and all the different kinds of ways to get into that game, NFTs, online gambling. People are just thinking... even the startup world is seeing more and more angel investors. So, and these are some of the more speculative type bets.
Right. Yeah. And honestly, Mark, that terrifies me. Like, I don't speculate with any money you can't afford to lose. Like, throw that out there as a general rule. But it's not healthy. It can be very dangerous. So,
Well, it can be dangerous for someone personally. Do you think it could be dangerous for the economy and that it's creating a bubble?
Yeah, I mean, you know, anytime a bubble pops, that can be disastrous. But I do believe in kind of fundamental value creation with these new technologies. It's just a matter of kind of sorting the good from the bad. And, you know, that takes time. But even the world of venture capital, folks view it as this like high risk, you know, wild, wild west industry. And I mean, not to say that there's none of that going on, but that's not the way good venture investors work. We build deliberate portfolios of companies. We build relationships with these startups that could last a decade. This, it's not a get rich quick scheme. And, you know, somebody will get rich quick somewhere, but most people will lose their shorts if that's the game they're playing. And so, you know, we're looking for great teams going after remarkable markets that we can work with for the long haul. It's been anecdotally said that the average venture investment lasts longer than the average marriage in America. You know, like these are real relationships we're trying to build.
I've never
heard
that before.
Well, and you know, God bless my wife. We've already beat the average.
You passed the average. I passed it a while back myself. Well, so thinking more on the trend side, I've seen valuations increase. It feels like over the last 5 or 10 years
too.
Is that continuing, or you think there'll be pushback on that?
Yeah. So there's a couple things that are going on. I don't think valuations are going to come crashing back down to earth anytime soon. I very much believe in the value created by technology companies and the long-term potential of these companies. That said, especially in the very early stages of investment, you know, valuations, in my opinion, feel a lot more like you know, the art of a negotiation than they do necessarily the underlying value of the company being created. When you've got, you know, a well-established corporation, you can price these companies based on their discounted cash flows. There's like easy formulas.
There's
and multiples.
Comps, yeah.
Exactly. But when you're an early stage company who's, you know, 99% of your future value doesn't exist yet and it hasn't been fully proven, you know, any comps that do exist are kind of meaningless, and a discounted cash flow is all mumbo jumbo hocus pocus. And so the valuation becomes a function of how many investors are willing to give you a term sheet or make an investment, and you let them compete for the price they're willing to pay.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, it's supply and demand. If you have five people that want to buy one asset or 50 people that want to buy one asset, I mean, these kind of numbers drive the valuations.
Exactly.
The founder is in a little bit better negotiating position. But we're seeing we're seeing a lot more of that. You're thinking that that's not going to change a whole heck of a lot because there's that much capital, and there, even if interest rates tick up, there's going to continue to be that kind of capital out there.
So you've hit the nail on the head. If there is a change, it will be in a reduction of the amount of capital available, which means fewer investors driving the price up. That's the most likely thing that would lower valuations on average. But what bothers me about all of that is, like, when you talk about valuation fluctuation, we're not talking about value creation fluctuation. It's just purely what dollars are available. So we'll see. If interest rates go up and it's easier to make a return elsewhere, then you probably will see some dollars.
And with that said, has there ever been a better time to start a company? I mean, there's so much money chasing. I don't want to say so few because there aren't that many startups, but I mean, great startups are harder to find than there are dollars. And it's interesting to think about, why wouldn't you either go to work for a high growth startup and be, you know, to learn and become exposed and maybe take some early equity or stock options or something? Why not get involved in it when there's so much money driving up the valuations?
Yeah, no, amen. I mean, so you know, you mentioned I work at UC Davis. I get to hang out with hundreds of brilliant students every day. And, you know, what's really interesting, Mark, with these students of mine, you know, they're getting job offers from Facebook. They're getting job offers from Microsoft. I mean, making more money than, boy, we won't say numbers, but oh my goodness, like 20 years old making that much money. It's remarkable. And it's really hard to walk away from something like that. But you have an opportunity to use those talents like at an early stage company. I mean, boy, that company could take off. It could life-changing wealth, but definitely life-changing experience.
Yeah, if there's a parent out there, or a college student, high school student thinking about, you know, wanting to be an entrepreneur, or, I mean, it came up in my entrepreneurs organization as a question. If you were advising a college graduate today on what to do with their career as they were graduating, I would advise them – if they have ambition, go to work for one of the fastest growing companies in the region, somebody who's venture backed here in Sacramento, and go dominate. Go put everything you have into standing out, making a difference, being way different. And next thing you know, you're one of the top employees in a rocket ship type company. That's a recipe for tremendous success and a tremendous education.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, just to give an example. So at UC Davis, we run an accelerator program called Plasma. Every year we take in 10 or 12 undergrad teams. These are all undergrad founders from across campus, a bunch of different majors. And last year we had one team called Seas. They're a photo sharing app, you know, really cool technology. Altair Jin, she was one of our founders, computer science student at UC Davis. Her co-founder, Dana Wiggins, actually from University of Maryland, working together. And, you know, they finished the program, you know, highly rated, you know, won one of our awards on our demo day, had these job offers from Microsoft and Amazon, respectively. And they took those jobs. They're working on them for a few months and then got invited to Techstars, you know, one of these preeminent startup accelerator programs in the country. And it was this big wrestle. Like, do I leave this killer job to go to go into the unknown? You know, this could go belly up in 6 months. We don't know. And my thought that I shared with them, and you know, forgive any parents out there who don't want to hear the advice, but like, look, you're gonna have that on your resume forever. And if it takes off, you'll be superstars. And if it doesn't, you still were the initiative and the drive that you demonstrate by working at a Techstars backed company, founding a Techstars backed company. My opinion, worst case scenario, you go right back to the jobs you had before. And if not, maybe even like a step or two ahead because you have these leadership chops now. That's not a bad outcome. It is riskier. It's less well-defined. You know, the path is not as obvious as it is going to a big tech company or, again, you know, the bank or the consulting firm. But you can't beat that experience.
I think people, I would like to see a few more people that really have drive and creativity and some of the things that go into being successful. I would love to see them think about taking a little bit more risk with their career.
Yeah.
Just think a little, dream a little bit bigger. You can dream about going and being mid-management at Microsoft. Okay, that's a great job. But dream about something bigger. Can't you envision really changing the world?
Right. Well, this is where I think, Mark, we can be really helpful. These folks that maybe hadn't caught the vision yet, or there's real credible reasons why taking a risk is hard. I am 50 grand in debt from my undergrad, and my parents, you know, never dreamed of making as much money as I could make at one of these jobs. Like, how do we help them? But I mean, this is why I love the university setting. So here in our College of Engineering, we've had, you know, just some of our plasma teams and the ambition that these students had. We got one that's, you know, working on 3D printing spider silk for medical applications. You know, we got one that used the waste product of faba beans to make an allergen-free ice cream so kids aren't going to the hospital.
Nice.
You know, an education app to help special needs students in school districts. You know, these are killer teams. And what's really interesting about a lot of them is they come into the program, you know, without business experience. They were like me. They didn't, you know, go to business school, didn't know what a balance sheet was on day one. These are engineers that know how to build. And you know, if we can coach them, help them, guide them to find, you know, great networks and mentors, you know, thoughts on the appropriate revenue model, well, then all these things that made business, you know, ethereal and hard to understand and just foreign, they aren't scary anymore. And then you can go build. But that requires a network of the willing to come in, step in, and help these teams out.
Did you ever work with any of the ones that are gone through the growth factory out of UC Davis? I'm thinking like Rivada Solutions.
Yeah. So
they're changing, they're fixing a big problem.
Yeah, no, Gherkin has been one of our great mentors at UC Davis. So yeah, he predated me. I wish I could claim credit for him. But he's come back. I mean, he's a great example of the mentors coming back, like, you know, pay it forward kind of experience. But that's just, these aren't easy problems these folks are solving. Like high tech, medical, it's regulated. Like if it goes wrong, you know, I mean, shoot, you know, you screw up in one of these industries, you might kill somebody. It's not just pure software.
Well, he's working on in vitro fertilization, and I think he's using animals to start.
Right.
So still, you know, there's all kinds of life-threatening type consequences anything. But but really you think about changing the world, changing lives.
Right.
And instead of going and getting a job.
Yeah, totally. No, I didn't mean to suggest Rivada was out killing anybody. Forgive me if I said something.
Come on, Gherkin.
But the point here is it's messy. Like, especially you got to prove that technology takes a lot of years. Yeah, that requires a lot of investment of time, money, and support and help. But those are the companies that change the world. Peter Thiel wrote a book a while ago called Zero to One, and he made this really interesting comment that kind of haunted me. And he said, you know, the last 500 years have been marked by tremendous, like, technological transformation. You know, we go from, like, you know, the horse pulling the plow as our most high-tech tech, right up until about the 1970s, he said, like, technology just changed everywhere. But he said, we've hardly had any transformation from 1970 on. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he said, with the exception of communications/the internet. So his point was that, you know, the internet, of course, has changed the world. Like, you know, I think his comment was as much for shock value, but, you know, airplanes aren't any faster than they used to be. Lifespans aren't remarkably longer than they used to be. You know, we haven't been back to the moon since 1973 or whenever. You know, when's technology going to catch up everywhere else? And the thing I love about healthcare companies like Rivada, the thing I love about our ice cream company, Faba, it's more than just the software. You know, they're trying to really change the world in which we live in, and for the better. We tell our students every day, you know, if you want to build something new, if you want to create your own job, if you want to make the world a better place, there is no better tool than entrepreneurship to do that.
Who do you look up to? You mentioned Peter Thiel in the book Zero to One. Are there books or people that you look up to that maybe I should research, or audience might be thinking about getting a little bit more information about?
Yeah, I mean, shoot, Mark, I'll have to share it with you afterwards. I've got my whole syllabus and a gazillion list of summer readings to share with my students. But if there was one business mentor that I would speak to, he's a professor of mine when I was at Harvard. His name was Clayton Christensen. Passed away recently.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
How old? That guy's not that old, is he?
He's not too. He'd been ill. But just, if there was ever a genuine, like, good man, it was him. I don't think he'd know who I was. He wouldn't have recognized me on the street, but he was my professor and a remarkable man. He wrote, he's most famous for disruptive innovation. He wrote a book called The Innovator's Dilemma, followed with The Innovator's Solution. But he had one theory in particular that he always shared with us called Jobs to be Done Theory. He wrote another book about it called Competing Against Luck. But the basic premise was that businesses get themselves caught in this vicious cycle where they spend time and energy, you know, they can tell you everything about their customers' hair color and zip code and height and, you know, marital status, gender, ethnicity, these things that are, you know, anecdotally interesting but not causal in terms of the decisions they make when it comes to buying things. And Jobs to be Done theory, in short, said, what is the thing your customer is trying to accomplish in any given circumstance? And then they will hire you to help them accomplish that goal.
Okay.
And they'll fire you if you don't do it well. And he shared this really interesting story about a milkshake restaurant, of all things, that was just, you know, they were struggling. Weren't selling milkshakes. You know, they tried introducing new flavors and new toppings and fancy marketing campaigns and, you know, no luck. Milkshake sales were flat. And so Professor Christensen tells the story of a consultant going out there, you know, just sitting in the restaurant every day for a week. And every time, you know, a customer bought a milkshake, he jotted down the time of day and asked them, you know, why'd you buy a milkshake? What were you doing? And what was really interesting about that story is that there were 2 hours of the day they found where sales peaked. And they're not the times you would have thought. It was 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. were peak milkshake sales times. And it turns out, well, the 7 a.m. crowd, you might guess, is, you know, they're commuting. They're on their way to work. They need breakfast.
Yeah.
But not just any breakfast. You want something enjoyable. And so, because, you know, the long, hard day of work coming up, hour-long commute on the drudgery. And so, like, you know, the milkshake wasn't competing with other dessert options. It was competing with a granola bar. But, you know, you eat the granola bar in, you know, 3 minutes. Banana, you know, I mean, shoot, you finish the banana before you're out of the driveway. Eating oatmeal while you're driving is a dangerous proposition. Coffee, you might spill in your lap and get hurt and stain your clothes. And so the milkshake was, you know, it's tastier.
That's really
interesting. It's more enjoyable. It lasts longer. And so recognizing that the job to be done was not, I want to eat a milkshake, but I'm looking for an enjoyable breakfast that will make my commute better. Well, all they did with the milkshake, they made it a little thicker so it lasts longer. They removed the toppings so they don't get wedged in the straw while you're driving. and sales took off. And you know, the 3 p.m. crowd, very similar, but opposite. It was parents bringing their kids home from school, wanted a nice treat. So they made the milkshakes thinner so the kids can drink the milkshakes real quick, because heaven knows, you know, like a five-year-old at McDonald's with a milkshake is a mess, a disaster. Get me out of here. And sales took off because they realized what it was their customers were trying to do with their particular milkshakes.
Clayton Christensen. Okay, so I know The Innovator's Dilemma. What was that book?
Competing Against Luck.
I don't think I read that one.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's called Jobs to be Done Theory. So,
okay.
Professor Christensen's class was called Building and Sustaining Successful Enterprises. We talked about Innovator's Dilemma, Disruptive Innovation. But Jobs to be Done Theory was the one that like bored its hole into my brain, and I'll never forget it.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I want to give you a chance to maybe share some closing thoughts, advice to the people that might be in our audience, which might be startups, it might be angel investors, it might be a small business person, or somebody that cares about those kind of people. So maybe closing thoughts and maybe just some words of wisdom.
Yeah. Well,
not that you haven't provided a lot already.
Oh, Mark, you put me on the spot. So one of the kind of the big insights for me, and I think for my students at UC Davis, is that, you know, when you recognize that a startup is not the same thing as a fully scaled business, large businesses are in the business of executing proven business models. Startups are in search of repeatable and scalable business models. They haven't discovered them yet. So if I've learned anything about the world of startups, it's that startup founders need to approach their very early stage businesses as if they're science experiments. You use the scientific method, you have a hypothesis about how you think the world is going to work, and then you need to work tirelessly, diligently, and deliberately to prove or disprove that hypothesis. And lean in when you think you've discovered something, abandon it quickly if it doesn't work, but don't have the hubris to think that your own intuition is somehow smarter than what your customers are telling you, that you understand the world better than someone else does. You probably don't. I think the best entrepreneurs are not the smartest people in the room. They're the people that do the best job surrounding themselves with the smartest people in the room and then question everything and are honest as they get answers back. They, you know, they don't try to manipulate the data to say what you want it to say. You see the world as it really is in ways that nobody else does. I think the same applies for investors. You'll make a lot of bad investments, but you know, invest in those founders that can articulate the way the world works in unexpected ways.
Ah, I love it. Aaron Anderson, Impact Venture Capital, as well as UC Davis, and a leader in the Sacramento entrepreneurial ecosystem. Thanks for all that you do, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, Mark, it's a pleasure. I hope it was helpful.
It's great. Thank you. Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show, and today I hope you enjoyed today's show. I thought Aaron was fantastic. He is fantastic, but I think today's show was quite informative. He mentioned a couple of books that made an impact on him, and as I think about books that have made an impact on me, there's some that have had a tremendous impact, but one that has to do with the entrepreneurial ecosystem right here in the hometown we love, and it's called The Rainforest, and it's co-authored by Victor Hwang, H-W-A-N-G, and Greg Horowitz. These two have written a book around building a startup ecosystem that attracts venture capital, and some of the insights in that book are unique, because we hear oftentimes about bureaucrats or government agencies or people that aren't really entrepreneurs, that haven't been there, done that, sort of making recommendations on how to make this happen. And in the book, The Rainforest, they talk about there's no way to completely orchestrate the ecosystem. It needs to happen naturally, similar to the way things grow wild in the rainforest. So if you have interest in being a part of Sacramento's entrepreneurial ecosystem, obviously, you can get a hold of me. If you want to be a part of the Growth Factory, you can get a hold of me. You can go to growthfactory.us, or, of course, hit me up on social media at The Mark Haney. And all you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life, and all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship, you know, here at the Growth Factory, here at Haney Biz, we're never above you. We're never below you. We're always by your side.
Can you see by the dawn? proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight wore the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming. Young rocket track.
Personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.